Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we discuss artificial intelligence, pros and cons, and how AI might impact not only the future workplace, but education, the arts, and more. Ben Pring is IT futurist and author, co-founder and former leader of Cognizant Center for the Future of Work. Hi, Ben.
Morning, Mindy.
Maybe we should start with what AI is.
Let's start with the hardest question to answer, shall we? Well, it's a variety of things. It's a catch-all term, really, that people are using to describe very powerful algorithms that people are writing. And there's lots of different sub-themes, if you like, within this different styles of AI. But it's basically software that can act increasingly independently of just fulfilling a command that you as a human person would give it. So it's software that's basically getting smarter and smarter and being able to do more and more things independently. Mm-hmm. As I say, there's lots of different styles of AI and lots of different terms that are floating around in the market at the moment that people probably are hearing. Gen AI, large language models, reinforcement learning. But we probably don't have time to go into all the technical details of what these things. But suffice to say, it's just software that people use every day on their phone, on their computer, different aspects of their life, which is just getting smarter and smarter and more independent. Mm.
And there are lots of people excited about AI and others who are a little bit more leery. So first, talk about why the excitement.
Yeah. Well, if you're in the tech world, this is probably the biggest thing that's ever happened in tech. This is sort of science fiction dreams and fantasies and nightmares that we've all seen in movies and TV and books over hundreds of years, now beginning to become real. And it's the culmination of 70 or 80 years of a real tech industry, if you like, since the Second World War and since the commercialization of a computing industry. And it is a very, very big deal. I've been a sort of tech analyst and futurist for my entire career, for 40 plus years. I was very closely associated with watching the rise of cloud computing in the last 25 years. And cloud computing, which everybody's using, you know, routinely now and doesn't really think about to watch Netflix or to use WhatsApp or, you know, a whole range of technologies. That's been a huge technological revolution, which has changed the world. But I think it's safe to say that this revolution that we're on the cusp of and a relatively early stage of is going to be far, far bigger than the cloud computing revolution. So the cloud computing revolution created the world's richest people. This revolution is going to create people who are wealthy beyond anybody's imagination, really.
So we're in a historic moment then right now.
I think this is the great story of our time. Clearly, there's lots of big waves, big dynamics happening in the world. But I think this is the biggest one. This is going to change every aspect of society, of how we live, of how we make a living, of how we educate our kids, how we heal ourselves. And there's lots of grandiose claims around, and it's I'm sure a lot of people sort of roll their eyes and and think this is all a bit exaggerated. But it is a big deal, and it's going to take longer to roll out than some of the sort of folks who are hyping this are suggesting. This is a generational change. It's going to take 20, 30, 40, 50 years to fundamentally change society. But it is a very big deal. And for people at any stage of their life, young or old, I think it is a smart thing to do, to be paying attention to this, because it is a big deal.
Yeah. And before we get into some of the different sectors, as with everything, there are pros and cons. What do you see as the overall impact? I'm sure there's positive and negative, but overall, are you seeing it as a positive thing, right?
Well, the way I sort of think about this, Mindy, is put it into a historical context, because we've sort of seen this movie before, and people who are familiar with the sort of history of industrial revolutions from the from the 1760s onwards through obviously the growth of America as a country based on the spread of technology. We've seen this movie before, so we sort of know what happens, that technology comes along and replaces the traditional way we have done things. And we've seen this in farming, we've seen this in automobile manufacturing. And I always say that we wouldn't be living today in the society we live in, for good or for bad, if it hadn't been for the technologies of the past, which people debated in the same way that people are debating AI. Lots of people wanted to stop previous waves of technology, and there was good reason to do that, but as a society, we didn't. We voted to use technologies in every aspect of life, automobiles, supermarkets, television, media, and lots of people along the way were displaced by those ways of technology, but we as a society decided we wanted to leverage the upside of this rather than focus on the downside of this. And I think that's the moment we're at again now, that these technologies are going to change how we do things. They're going to create winners and losers, as technology always has done. But on balance, this is going to push us forward into a society that's hopefully better. And I think that's the only sort of reasonable position a moderate sensible person can have, that there is going to be displacement, there is going to be disruption. We need to manage those things. But on balance, this is going to create a better society for more people, which is ultimately, in a sort of utilitarian context, the goal that we should be aiming for.
Yeah. So we want to be on the winning side. So that's why it's good to pay attention, right? And so sure. I think a lot of people think about jobs, right? It seems logical that AI will replace people in some tasks, right? Yep. But people are still needed. So how do you see AI impacting jobs? And is it something we should be concerned about?
Yes, this is the most thorny issue at the heart of what the whole discussion around AI is going to be. I think it's unquestionable that this is going to replace human labor in certain aspects. And I think people who deny that, and there are a lot of people in the tech industry who do deny that, I think they're not speaking fully truthfully, if you like, because the fear, the concern that people have got, I think, is a reasonable one. And we're already beginning to see that in data that's coming out of academic institutions, beginning to appear in sort of official government statistics. We're already beginning to see that. And so I think, again, this is, from a completely pragmatic perspective, why people should be paying attention to this, because it behooves every individual, as well as the institution they work in, the organization they work in, to be figuring out how to remain relevant, how to remain employable, how to remain in touch with technology, which is moving very, very quickly. In the area that I've spent my whole life, the technology industry, this is already beginning to replace human software engineers. And for the last 10 years or so, that's been one of the hottest employment spaces, and we've been telling young people go into software engineering. There's a great future in that, but already we're beginning to see that this software can actually write software. So yes, it's again, this is going to be the crucial aspect that society needs to manage, maintaining human employment, maintaining human relevance in an age in which machines can do more and more.
Yeah. But don't we still need a programming? I mean, isn't AI's capabilities sort of based on how you program it?
Yes, yes. No, that's completely true. It's still a human targeted objective that the software is trying to aim at. And so, yes, the human, whether they're giving the software very detailed instructions or just a prompt, a high-level prompt, which is the new terminology in the industry, prompt engineering. You just tell the software what you want it to do, and it goes away and does that, and you don't need to be particularly involved in how it does it. So yes, so humans will continue to be important in those aspects, but I think what the impact in the short to medium term will be, we'll just need less of those people doing it because the software becomes more and more capable every day.
Can AI, can you program creativity or empathy?
Yes, this is an amazing sort of plot twist in the story, because again, the people who've been in this area for a long time have been talking about the benefit of AI software being that it could take away the boring bits of your job and allow you to do the more interesting sort of creative aspects of your job. But the plot twist is that the software actually seems more capable at doing the creative things than the boring things. And so people may have seen a year or so ago a big strike in Hollywood. All the writers in Hollywood were on strike, and there were various factors underneath that, various reasons why they were on strike. But one of them was this fear of AI, that that movies are going to be made with fewer people because they're using AI. TV shows will be used using fewer people. That was not particularly well known or well articulated aspect of concern about exactly this. And people may have seen, there's quite a good example of this that's quite easy to see at the moment on YouTube or Spotify, a rock and roll band called Velvet Sundown, who are sort of getting big. And now it's come out that it's completely AI. The AI is completely created the music. The AI is completely created the people, the seeming people that are singing the song. And lots of people are sort of listening to this and thinking, oh, this sounds good. This sounds a bit like Fleetwood Mac. I like this. And then realizing it's AI. And so, again, that's an example of where we weren't really expecting that. We weren't really expecting that software could do something as creative as writing songs and songs that sound pretty good.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think some people have a better talent at knowing what's AI and what's not. And I just recently went to my hairdresser and I brought this picture and I said, you know, this is, I like this. And she said, well, that's AI. Hair doesn't do that. I was like, how would you know that, right?
this is a kind of funny example of what's called hallucinations in the tech industry, where the software creates something that's essentially wrong. It's sort of making it up. The software thinks it's right. It thinks that haircut is, you know, a real haircut. It's a funny but kind of serious aspect of, can we trust this technology? Because obviously in that example, it's kind of relatively comical, but if it's software being used in an important financial transaction or in a military security context, the need to be able to trust the software 100% is absolutely paramount, clearly.
Yeah. So how do you fact check AI?
Using AI. I think this is part of the sort of learning curve that we individually and collectively are on, is being able to use the technology in a way that we feel assured that it is correct, the answer is correct, that it isn't hallucination. And part of that oversight or that sort of audit capability, if you like, in a financial context is still going to be human based, but there are, you know, increasingly tools that will be checking other software tools. So you have a sort of adversarial relationship between your piece of AI and my piece of AI, and then there's human oversight on top of it. But that's going to be, again, for serious people in serious occupations. If you're an executive in a large organization and you're betting your career on using this software, because if it goes wrong, you know, you're going to be probably out on the street. You're going to be very focused on making sure that these sort of hallucinations are not happening on your watch.
Yeah. We are talking about artificial intelligence. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about artificial intelligence this morning with Ben Pring. He's IT futurist, author, and co-founder and former leader of Cognizant Center for the Future of Work. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, Ben, what does AI mean for education and young people?
Yes, this is, again, one of the sort of most important areas we're going to see, and we are seeing AI play out. And there are different schools of thought on what AI means. You know, one school of thought suggests that educators should go fully in on teaching AI literacy and skills to young people. And then there's a completely contrary school of thought suggesting that we should keep young people away from this technology for as long as possible, that we shouldn't be exposing them to technologies that they can use to effectively, and I put this in sort of air quotes, cheat by using the technology, that we should continue to focus on teaching kids fundamentals, without the fundamental knowledge, the foundational knowledge they get through the whole K through 12 experience, then they're going to be adrift. And I feel, again, that the answer, the correct answer, is somewhere in the middle of that. I think it's clearly illogical to imagine that we can keep kids away from this technology indefinitely. They're going to be exposed to it in different aspects of their life, their personal life, and their family. But at the same time, if we completely throw away the traditional foundations of knowledge, then I think that behooves is going to lead us towards a world in which machines are becoming smarter and humans perhaps are becoming less smart. There's already data coming out of, again, academia, suggesting that people who are overly reliant on technology, their IQ capacity is actually shrinking. And that should be an alarm call, a wake-up call for people. I've talked for a long time about the way that, not in education, but to think about this as a sort of canary in the coal mine, taxi drivers who used to have to know the town or the city that they were driving in, they'd have to know all the roads and all the back streets to be able to take somebody from A to Z. Now that's just Uber, or that's just the GPS software on their phone. It's a CarPlay on their phone. And so that knowledge, that human knowledge, has been subsumed into software. And now all you need to do is to be able to sort of click an address on the app. Where I come from originally, London, the knowledge, which was the sort of term that people used for taxi drivers to learn all the streets of London. And there used to be thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who had the knowledge, and it took about 3 years for them to learn all these streets, driving around on a moped in the evening or early in the morning. And now that's all software, and consequently, very few people do the knowledge now. And I think that's a lead indicator of the downside of this, that if we lean on the technology too much, and particularly for young people, that's going to be problematic. Young people have still got to learn to read, to write, to be able to do math. And I think that will be true into the indefinite future.
Yeah. You mentioned GPS. We were in Vermont last month and we lost the satellite, right? So all of a sudden, like, I know we're not going the right direction, but we couldn't figure out where we missed the turn. And, we stopped at a gas station and they don't sell maps anymore. I was like, just give me a map, right? I can tell you where we need to go.
No, it's funny you say that. was at a gas station in Falmouth the other day, and elderly gentleman stopped me and said, "How do I get to Orleans from here?" And I thought, "Do you not have a phone? Do you not?" And he and trying to explain how you get from Falmouth to Orleans is tough. And so again, as a metaphor for a world in which we've outsourced our intelligence to technology, what happens in that world when the internet implodes or there's a nuclear war and we don't have this technology? We're going to be very, very stuck if that's if something terrible like that happens.
All right, so let's talk about healthcare. This may be an area where we could see AI being a pretty useful tool, I would think.
No, again, this is an area there's a huge amount of focus from everywhere, from sort of basic research for new medicines through to treating patients. Google, who are one of the leading players in AI, they have been focused through one of their groups called DeepMind on something that's called protein folding, which is a very esoteric and leading edge sort of technology where they're trying to understand how proteins emerge, how they develop, and how they can be tailored for new medicines that prevent, not just cure, but prevent diseases happening. In fact, the leader of that company and that group, Demis Hassabis, recently won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for his work in using AI to do this kind of research. So that's very important. And then just this week, I saw a robot surgeon at Johns Hopkins University being publicized, where the software had completely removed the robot using AI software had removed a gallbladder completely itself without any human involvement at all. So,
Wow.
yeah,
That's
no,
talk
absolutely,
about science
absolutely.
fiction, right?
Yeah, no. This is what we've seen in Star Trek and in Jetsons and the Star Wars, and this is coming true. So, yes, that whole area is clearly one of the areas, as technology has always done before, which has improved the human condition. We 200 years ago, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there was very little medicine, and now there's a lot of medicine, and humans live longer, and the population of the world is much healthier because of that technology. And this is now a new wave of technology that's going to hopefully, continue to improve human lives.
What does AI mean for the arts?
Again, this is an interesting question because, as I was saying earlier on, the technology can become increasingly capable itself. It can produce that song. OpenAI, that is the company behind ChatGPT, have said in the last couple of weeks that they want to create a full-length animated movie using this technology. And that's an undertaking that if you watch the end of a movie nowadays, you see thousands and thousands of names of human artists and creatives and technicians and people involved in that movie. Imagine a movie made with half a dozen people because the software has done that. So that's happening, and I think you're conversely beginning to see a great pushback against that humans are increasingly stating. And the director of the new Frankenstein movie, Guillermo del Toro, recently said that this movie has no AI in it whatsoever, no technology in it whatsoever. He wants to get away from that technology. He wants the movie to be a sort of human, fully human experience. And I think that's, again, a lead indicator of people pushing back on this technology. We don't want that AI rock and roll band. We want a human rock and roll band. We don't want a movie full of green screens and AI and characters with funny haircuts like you were talking about earlier on. We want real people in that. So, again, I think this is going to oscillate between the technology taking us into new possibilities and clearly all sorts of creative arts are now already full of a lot of technology, And people sort of pushing back against that, that we don't want this to be fully technology leveraged. We want the technology to be part of the experience, but not fully the experience. Again, I sort of, in a historical context, I sort of draw a parallel between what's going on at the moment and the emergence of photography in the middle part of the 19th century. I think it's undeniably true, and there's a lot written about the impact that photography had on painting. And I've seen it argued that the whole impressionist wave and post-impressionist wave in Europe and other parts of the world was really a reaction to the emergence of photography, because now a portrait of a person, which had been one of the main areas of painting for hundreds of years, now the photo was better than the painting in representing that person. And so that created a need to try and offer a human view, a human impression, in a different way from just reproducing what a photo could do better than a human. And I think that's, again, a sort of example of how this technology is going to change things in strange ways, because we're going to have to accommodate this new AI technology and also find new things that the technology can't really do as well as us.
Yeah. It's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that impressionism kind of following the advent of photography. It'll be curious to see what happens in that sort of that artistic world of painting with AI, because it's art is subjective to begin with. So you may have people going, well, I like this. I don't care if it's created by a human or AI, right? And others will be,
There are certainly artists already. I mean, people may have been up to Mass MoCA in North Adams and seen the Laurie Anderson virtual reality installation there. And she's been a sort of leading artist on the edge of technology for a long period of time. And when you see the collision of technology, in this case, virtual reality technology, but that will increasingly be sort of infused with more powerful AI technology underneath it, you see that collision between technology and an artist creating completely new, unimaginable domains and perspectives and environments for people to explore. That I find that very exciting and very interesting, and I think we're going to see a lot of that.
Yeah. So we sort of touched on that. Those of us who are of a certain age, this is science fiction coming to life, right? So what does it mean for older people or those who are mid-career?
Yeah. I think that's a great question, Mindy. I think because this does mean different things to different people. I think if you're a young person, you have to go, that caveat about education that we talked about earlier on. I think you have to go into this, full steam ahead. This is going to be crucial to your career. If you're just graduating from university, from college, you need to fully embrace this. If you're an older person, then perhaps this isn't such a big deal. This isn't going to play out particularly meaningfully in the rest of your life. You're probably going to see it through your children, your grandchildren, the young people around you, them experiencing. But it's not going to fundamentally change how you experience the world in the rest of your life. But I think the crucial thing, and you just touched on it, is people in mid-career. I think this is where, again, it gets really challenging and really difficult, because if you're if you're in your mid-40s, you've probably got a mortgage, you're paying for a family, you're trying to save money for your retirement, you're trying to save money for your kids' education, and then suddenly this technology comes along and can impact your career and impact your career security, then it's difficult for that person in their 40s, their 50s or whatever to suddenly start again or suddenly learn new technology, which seems foreign and alien and kind of scary to them. So I think that's the part of this sort of distribution, age distribution, that I worry most about, people in mid-career. And again, I think it behooves those people to pay attention to this rather than put their heads in the sand and hope it'll go away, because it isn't going to go away.
No.
They have to figure out how they inject this into what they're doing, how they implement this in the work that they do, and make sure that they are keeping up with the times. And I certainly, in the work that I do with companies and big corporations, see examples of where companies are saying to their employees, look, the world is changing, this technology is impactful, we want to deploy it, it's going to be important for our economic health going forward, and you've got to come along on this journey. We want you to come along on this journey with you. We don't just want to fire thousands of people willy-nilly. We've got to do this together, but you've got to show willing to continue to figure out how to use this software. You've got to figure out how you upskill your job, how you implement this in your career. And that sort of balance between the employee and the employer, I think, is very important going forward. Both parties have to show willing to do this. And that person in mid-career who says, I don't want anything to do with this, this isn't how I've done this successfully, this my job for 20 years, imagining that they can successfully continue to do that job for the next 20 years, I think that's a bit of a mistake.
Yeah. We're talking about artificial intelligence. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about artificial intelligence this morning with Ben Pring, IT futurist, author, and co-founder and former leader of Cognizant Center for the Future of Work. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the things when I'm thinking about artificial intelligence, we talk a lot about bias and, biases we may have that we aren't even really aware of. And it seems like that would be an area that AI would be able to perform maybe without some bias. But then what about algorithm bias?
Yeah. No, again, this is a very important area. And within the tech industry, there's a lot of work going on to handle this problem. Frankly, it's not a solved problem, because one man's bias is another man's perfectly reasonable, moderate perspective. So trying to sort through the differing claims that lead to bias is going to be very, very challenging. And so, yes, this is an area where I think we as individuals in using this technology have to be very sort of alert to what those biases, explicit or implicit, may be. And again, this may be a limiting factor to the growth of some AI technology, that people simply are not aligned in the user is not aligned with the bias within that technology, and just sort of rejects it because it doesn't align with their view of the world, their view of how things should operate. I think in the future, what we'll see is a lot of to what you might call algorithm audit. Trying to understand what are the weights. The weights is a technical term that basically tells the software to do one thing and not another thing, to understand the what with the large language model, and be quite upfront about this. This is the point of view. This is the perspective of technology. Fine, if you don't like that, you're aware. Buyer be aware. Caveat emptor. And then we might also see control mechanisms on top of the technology, where you can basically adjust the biases within it. You can, as the user, you can say, "I this is my view of the world. This is what I like. This is what I don't like," and make adjustments in the technology. So again, it aligns with what you want. But as I say, it's a very, very hot area. There's a lot of academics focusing on this. People who are familiar with OpenAI will probably have seen last year a big collision between different people within the organization. The CEO of the company, Sam Altman, left the company briefly because it was an argument, a fight within the leaders, the executives of that organization about exactly this issue. So it's a very tough one. And again, I think it's at the end of the day for individuals using this software. Proceed with caution and try and be smart in the way that you're using the technology so you don't fall into these types of traps.
The Cape, generally speaking, when it comes to trends, we're about 10 years behind whatever the current trend is, right? Is that the case here, or are we on par with the rest of the world?
No, I think there's one of the really interesting things about this technology is that, excuse me, is that in previous waves of technology, you needed to have a data center or you needed to have a big budget to spend a lot of money with a cloud computing provider like Amazon Web Services. And you probably needed to be in one of the sort of centers, one of the financial capitals, one of the population centers of the world. You needed to be in New York or in London or in San Francisco to sort of be in touch with technology and to be able to use technology. Nowadays, that's completely changed. And this technology, all of this amazing technology that people are seeing and that I've been talking about this morning, is all literally in the palm of your hand. It's in the phone that's in the palm of your hand. You have the ability to access incredibly leading-edge technology in a way that's never been the case before. So the means of production, if you like, in an economic context, are literally in your hand. And I think what we're seeing is that smart people, people who are tuned into this, who are interested in this, are already beginning to use this technology outside of those traditional capitals, if you like, capitals of capital, as you might say. And I think so that applies to the Cape as much as anywhere else. There's quite a healthy ecosystem of technology companies on the Cape already, many of them associated with what's called the blue economy, the sea economy, if you like, that's all around us. And clearly in places like Hui and in Woods Hole, and there are lots of smart scientists who are already using these types of technology. Then there are companies like Onset Data Loggers who are very much into this type of technology already. And I think this gives an opportunity for folks on the Cape and the islands to be much more in touch with what's going on than has previously been the case. Now, that sort of 10-year lag that you touch on, I think there's still an element of truth to that, Mindy, and I think it would be hard to sort of deny that there's truth to that. But I think we're going to see that window, if you like, that lag. Shrink a little bit as more and more people can use this in whatever they're doing here on the Cape.
What about the impact on things like social media, disinformation? I mean, Facebook used to be, I think, interesting. Now it's just full of junk. So what do you see happening in social media world?
No, this is a problem again, and people are using the phrase slop now, that social media is just full of slop. And whereas you used to follow people you actively liked and you actively sort of sought out and you followed, now your feed is just full of slop, just AI generated. And again, I think that's true. And I think that people in the tech industry are aware of that. The financial incentives for doing it are quite strong. And that's why we're sort of seeing it grow at the moment. But I think, again, as the user, as the audience for that, we simply have the power of turning that stuff off. We don't follow that slop. We say, don't show me this again. And I think the social media environment, which is clearly not terribly healthy to begin with in many ways, is becoming infected with this in a big way at the moment. And again, is not a sign of health. And so the sort of self-correcting nature of our relationship with technology hopefully addresses that in sort of the next few months and years.
So what are the other technologies that are important for us to be paying attention to?
Yes, I mean, there's so much attention on AI at the moment, and there's not really much oxygen for anything else. Everybody's really focused on this. But there are big tech waves and tech developments happening sort of beneath the surface, which are becoming more and more important. And two I would call out. One is in terms of the visual representation of data and information. And what I mean by that is that we all look at and use technology through our phones and through our computers. So we're looking at a screen, but technology is on the cusp of becoming more ambient. By that, I mean technology that isn't simply just portrayed to you through the phone, but can be portrayed to you through other devices. And I mentioned Sam Altman earlier on, the CEO of ChatGPT, OpenAI. He's just announced a relationship with Jony Ive, who was the designer of the iPhone and most of Apple's technology at Apple for 20 years, working closely with Steve Jobs. They've just announced a new company that's focused on this area of ambient technology, and people are debating what that device will be, and some people are saying it's going to be a pin that you sort of put on your shirt or your jacket, and it can hear the environment you're in, and it can make suggestions through a little earphone as to you, as to who you're talking to, what you should talk to them about, where you are. So that's a very important area. Again, it's sort of nascent at the moment, but it's going to be very, very interesting. And then another area, which there's been a lot of talk about for a long period of time, and it sounds science fiction to a lot of people still, is the whole idea of quantum computing. And quantum computing, which again is technologically very, very complicated to explain, is simply the next generation of even more powerful and faster computers, chips that are going to drive us into the next technology. And a supercomputer today, which would take hundreds of years to process a transaction, to an algorithmic task, these new generation of quantum computers, which are coming from companies like IBM and Google and specialists like D-Wave, they're going to do that transaction in nanoseconds. Mm. So imagine a computer that can do something which the fastest computer at the moment would take years to do in a nanosecond. What are we going to be able to do with that technology? And that to me is sort of mind-blowing, because that, again, is going to be part of the step, if you like, or the steps to take us fully into a science fiction world that we've seen in Star Wars or Star Trek, but that's going to, in our lifetime, that's going to begin to become real and true.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you look at that science fiction, that these things didn't exist except in science fiction, and now here they are. It's like the people who had these minds to think this stuff up, and then here it is, you know? It's crazy.
No, it's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah, no, yeah. I often think about the fact that my father died in 1993, so he never saw the internet.
Yeah,
he never saw cell phones. He never saw computers, you know, on a child's laptop. Yeah. We are living in a science fiction world that he would have seen in movies, but this is just, you know, completely real for us and mundane for us. And so again, fast forward another 30 years. What's the world going to look like then? Oh, very, very different. Very, very different, I'd suggest.
So what excites you about the future and the future of work, and what worries you?
What excites me is just the possibilities. This is opening up the possibilities in healthcare, in education, all the areas we've been talking about. This is going to create incredible new opportunity for people to do things better, to do things faster, to do things smarter. Imagine Without being too disrespectful, imagine you're going to the DMV in 20 years' time and the whole transaction just being seconds. And rather than you sitting there in the line for half an hour or whatever. So we're going to be able to make things better. That's, I think, the best case scenario of all of this. And as a futurist, as somebody who's excited by the possibility of technology, there hasn't been a better time to be alive. This is kind of mind-blowing. Even I, my mind is blown daily when I saw that John Hopkins robot surgeon recently. My mind is blown by that. The downside, of course, is that the displacement of human tasks with software, that is going to harm and hurt people. Again, I think undeniably that's going to be challenging for a lot of people, and I think we as people of goodwill and good faith and who want the best possible outcomes for the most number of people, we've got to work very hard and be intimately involved in this, engaged in this, to make sure that we can leverage the upside, as much of the upside as we possibly can, and minimize the downside. Many people listening now will have lived through a period of huge automation, blue collar automation, again in the automotive industry in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, and we can see that the damage that did to those towns, those societies that were based on that technology. If we do that again, if we in automating now white collar work or no collar work, the sort of technology industry itself, as it's sometimes called, if we automate those things away in a crude, simplistic, only financially interested way, then undoubtedly we're going to do some damage to society, and society will struggle to cope with that. So again, I think my role and people who are interested in all of this, our role is to maximize the upside and try and minimize the downside. And that's going to be work that only humans can do. And it's going to be work for, again, as far as I can see out.
So what practical tips do you have for people who are listening today in terms of keeping up with what's going on and what comes next?
Again, I think the most important thing is to educate yourself, is to not to be standing on the sidelines, kind of scared about this, listening to me or reading about this, and just then going back to sort of ordinary everyday life and everything you're doing and busy tasks. But it's to spend some time, weekends, evenings, whenever, figuring out these tools and using them. We were talking earlier on before we came on air about how you use the technology. And once you begin to use it in just everyday aspects of your life, you begin to realize this isn't a sort of monster hiding under the bed. This isn't a scary science fiction thing. This is just a tool that you can use, and it helps, what you're doing. And I speak to lots of non-technologists, sort of regular civilians, if you like, who are having that experience now and are using it and are being excited and want to explore it further. So I think that education, just diving in the pool, come on in, the water's fine. That's kind of important. A tech leader, a guy called Andrew Ng, who's very well known in the tech industry, said a few years ago that if you're somebody working in finance, as an example, you should be figuring out how to use the AI tools that are focused on the finance area. And then you could rewrite your CV, your resume, put it on LinkedIn, and you could probably get a job with 30% more pay, 40% more pay, if you know these technologies. I think that's a model that's available to everybody. Using this technology in your job, that's the route to getting to the next sort of performance level of your job, and thus, the next jump in salary that everybody wants.
Yeah, that's a motivating factor for sure, right?
Yes, no, yeah.
Ben Pring is IT futurist, author, and co-founder and former leader of Cognizant Center for the Future of Work. Ben, thanks so much. I learned a lot this morning. I really appreciate you sharing your insight with us.
My pleasure, Mindy. Great talking to you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.